You know, if you've looked at big cycles and things like, you know, the fourth turning, for example, right, you can see how like the generation that we have today, obviously being shaped by those experiences, has a distrust for these legacy institutions, these centralized institutions.
It's a very like insider's club. And if you're not in it, you're not going to be able to do anything to change that system. So Bitcoin provides a system in which you can build in parallel and build a competing financial system and arguably like a system through which to coordinate economic activity.
People are out there building a parallel system. They're not living in fear. Like, they're just out there doing it.
The statistics on the CDC website, it is asinine that we're forcing children to wear masks.
If Bitcoin wastes energy, well, what's a waste? Like, one man's trash is another man's treasure, isn't it?
To measure value throughout an economy, you distort economic decisions, particularly capital allocation. And so there's a good argument to be made that because we f*** the money by going off of sound monetary standard and completely detaching ourselves in 1971, just printing money out of nothing, pretending like there's going to be no consequences, that you have a mass misallocation of capital.
While tensions are nearing an all-time high, and the fears of the dollar's reset, a currency collapse, and the Great Reset are all looming, of course, people's feelings of fear, uncertainty, and doubt about the future are running at all-time highs. But there is hope. There's a new system that's being built in parallel. It's being built alongside the legacy system, and it's attracting some of the smartest people in the world to come and build, to transact, and conduct business. Now, today, I'm sitting down with Marty Bent, who is spearheading a movement to fix some of these legacy systems that are broken, including education, energy, and even the environment. Now, we discuss a wide range of topics, including how the events of 9/11 and the great financial crash of 2008 really shaped the worldview of these young adults, how the legacy systems have evolved to work against people's best interests, and how by fixing the pricing system of the world, we can fix almost everything else. Now, there's so much good stuff that we covered here, so let's just go ahead and just jump right into it with Marty. Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Market Disruptor Show, and today I'm sitting down with Marty Bent. He is the host of the Tales from the Crypt podcast, and he is also director of business development for Great American Mining. He's a lover of liberty, a patriot, and a freedom maximalist, we'll say. And so I want to dig into some conversations. I'm so excited to have you, Marty. Thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me, Mark. I'm excited for this conversation.
Yeah. So, you know, as I was kind of saying before, I've seeing the content you're putting out, which is a lot, obviously hosting the Tales from the Crypt podcast. And I know you write the newsletter. You've been doing that for a long time. Anyway, I've been following for a long time. Why don't you just tell everybody else kind of like what you're working on so they get an idea before we kind of dig into this?
Yeah. So the podcast was an extension of the newsletter. So I started the newsletter, Marty's Bent, around this time in 2017, June 8th, 2017. So about almost 4 years ago, exactly, less than a month, 3 years and 11 months ago. And I started that because I was known throughout my friend and family group as the Bitcoin guy, because I'd been falling down the Bitcoin rabbit hole since like 2013 when I was in college. And around that time in 2017, the price of Bitcoin was going up, the price of altcoins was going up, and everybody in my immediate circle was like, all right, Marty, what the hell's going on here? It was just a deluge of text and emails, calls. And I was like, all right, this is getting overwhelming. I'm going to write this daily newsletter, Marty's Bent, to inundate you with a little bit of Bitcoin information day by day, daily newsletter, 5 days a week. So it started out as that. And I started posting the newsletter to Twitter with links like, all right, I'm going to send this to my family and friends. Let's see if the Twitterverse likes it. Took on a life of its own. Got introduced to a gentleman at Barstool Sports, a big media company here in the Northeast, and it was talking to him, introduced him to my newsletter. We were talking about Bitcoin, and he convinced me to start Tales from the Crypt, the podcast. So that started, I believe, early September, late August, 2017. And again, that was an extension of podcast. People were liking the written content. And so I started Tales from the Crypt to give them some audio content and to introduce them to people building in the Bitcoin space, and whether it be code at the protocol level, apps, and building theses around the economics, innovation around Bitcoin as well, and the monetary revolution that it presents to the world. So I did that for a time. And then around beginning of 2018, I got introduced to the team at Great American Mining. They told me what they were doing with their mining operation. I was working at Barstool full-time at that point selling podcast advertising to Barstool's network and using their studios after hours to record Tales from the Crypt, and decided that I wanted to come, even though I'm working for Barstool. It was a really cool experience. It's something that a lot of
the new asset as well. Lots of ways you can do this. And BlockFi is the company that I recommend. Down in the description, I have a link that you can click on. If you choose to use that link, you can earn up to $250 in Bitcoin just for using that link. So check out BlockFi now.
Men my age particularly would kill to be in that position, but I was truly just drawn towards Bitcoin, and Great American Mining presented an opportunity to go work full time outside the podcast and the newsletter on Bitcoin. I sort of jumped at the opportunity, and here we are today. Great American Mining was in, I wouldn't say quasi stealth mode for a couple of years until we nailed down our exact path towards scalability, finding abundant and cheap energy. And we've been moving pretty quickly over the course of the last year, particularly to scale up our operations and go mine as much Bitcoin as possible. So yeah, I have a weird career, a weird way of making money right now, which is writing a daily newsletter, have this podcast, and I work for this mining company as well.
Yeah. Well, it's not weird. That's how it's done these days, right? That's the world's changed. So, you know, it's interesting, and I guess it's not weird necessarily from our perspective, but maybe from the outside looking in, it is. But it almost seems like, and you could probably talk to this, but like in the Ayn Rand novel of, you know, Atlas Shrugged, or in the movie, if you've seen it, you know, where it's like all the productive people in the world were like disappearing to go like start this like new system. And it seems like we've seen like this mind share, like all moving towards like this new technology, which I guess isn't that alarming, right? A new technology attracts all the best people. So whether that was the internet or whatever it was. And so it's attracting all these people. But I think, and I'd like to get your opinion on this, but it seems like maybe it's like the bait and switch where they come for the tech or they come for the money. But then when they learn what it really is, it kind of changes their mind and they just start seeing the world differently and they start seeing like solutions differently to problems and stuff.
No, I completely agree. And many Bitcoiners will say they had the same trajectory, but I did as well. Speak for myself. I was working at a managed futures fund in Chicago. I studied economics in college and interned at this managed futures fund in the West Loop. And, basically part of that job as an analyst, we're actually a fund of funds. So we index commodity trading advisors into a fund of funds. And we had many of those indexes across the business that we went out and sold to investors. And part of that was doing due diligence on the CTAs that we indexed and then their trading strategies. And part of that due diligence was understanding how markets were moving and the markets that CTAs trade, particularly our commodities markets, currency markets, equities, futures, any futures market that you can think of. And so that entailed me following central bank announcements, how currency exchange rates were fluctuating throughout time based off of macroeconomic factors, central bank policies, yada, yada, yada. And just through that process alone, I really, at a young age, came to realize that these experts, particularly the central banks or bankers, really didn't have any idea of what they were doing. They're sort of just throwing shit at the wall to see what sticks. And that really didn't sit well with me. And at the same time, I was discovering Bitcoin in my free time while still in college and learning about monetary policy. I think literally stumbled into Bitcoin, just randomly Googling obscure monetary policy or something like that, and stumbling upon people talking about Bitcoin's perfect monetary policy in forums on the internet, and the juxtaposition of the transparency of the Bitcoin ledger and its monetary policy next to what Janet Yellen at the time, who was Fed chairman when I was working at this fund, was doing, and how the markets were basically moving based off of the color of the jacket that she wore during press conferences and stuff like that. And everything they were doing was very non-transparent. And so that juxtaposition is what drove me in, this sort of stability and transparency of Bitcoin's monetary policy compared to what Janet Yellen and crew were throwing out there. And so, yeah, I came into it just from a purely geek perspective of, oh, this is like a unique sound monetary system experiment. And then, as you mentioned, as you dig deeper and you understand the distributed nature of the protocol, how it's geographically distributed, how proof of work works, how you come to consensus in the ledger, and how it enables individuals to make transactions in a peer-to-peer fashion. You go, whoa, this is actually bigger than money. It is a way to coordinate directly with other peers that can't be censored. And that is something that is desperately needed in this day and age. And so that's how I fell down. And I was radicalized before that. I think I was searching for something like Bitcoin, being 17 in 2008, when the great financial crisis went down, and really diving into the TARP bill with a professor that I had in high school when it was going down, and was like, this is messed up. I'm a child of 9/11, like going through that whole experience, and coming to find that maybe the pretenses for going to war with Iraq were fabricated, and just really a lot of distrust in the expert class and the traditional system. And Bitcoin provides an incredible way to escape the tyranny of this very, I would say, evil system. At the end of the day, it may not be overtly evil in the sense that the people running it have evil plans, but their implementation of their plans turns out to have evil consequences.
Yeah. Some interesting things that you said there that we can unpack, but the last kind of part, just kind of mentioning that, you know, a child of 9/11 and the great financial crash of 2008, et cetera. And it, you know, it's interesting. It's not surprising if you're paying attention, but you know, growing up under those different circumstances, of course, shapes your worldview. And so, you know, if you've looked at big cycles and things like, you know, the fourth turning, for example, right? You can see how like the generation that we have today, obviously being shaped by those experiences, has a distrust for these legacy institutions, these centralized institutions, but also want to enact change, which is, you know, one thing. And then we have a brand new technology, which of course a younger generation kind of grabs onto as well. So it's like definitely we have like the catalyst for like major change right now. But I would say going back to kind of what you're saying about looking at the central bank and the Federal Reserve and the fiat money system and like this centralized, you know, legacy system of fiat money. And it's really started to like spread over into everything. So we've seen like, you know, centralization of now the education system, you know, health and food, media, of course. And it's almost like these like distorted policies have like made their way into all of that now. Do you think that's happening? Like it's growing, or is it that we're just becoming more aware of it and seeing it all over there?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's been metastasizing for decades now. It's just becoming impossible to ignore of how pervasive the corruption and the distortion of reality has become. And I think a lot of Bitcoiners, I'm not going to say Bitcoiners in general, but a lot of Bitcoiners, particularly those who believe in sound money and particularly as a way to efficiently allocate capital, would say that the fact that we have this fiat monetary system that's run amok and allows you to print money ex nihilo and just allocate it, allows the central planners who print the money ex nihilo to allocate however they see fit, it leads to a distortion not only in the pricing mechanism of the currency at play, whether it be the US dollar, euro, yuan, yen, but also that disruption of the pricing mechanism leads to a misallocation of capital that then leads to a misallocation of incentives or creates the conditions for perverse incentives to arise and leads to a bastardization of the economy at large, just beyond the monetary system. As you said, leads into education, food, housing, coding that goes into housing, how towns are built, how suburban areas are built, and it bleeds into everything.
And I think it's easy, you know, most people can see that there's like, well, I don't know. It's like, it seems like obviously there's a lot of people that see there's something wrong. I mean, we see this populist uprising, which again is indicative of kind of like this fourth turning, or when, you know, civilizations change. And we had before pre-COVID, there was, I think, 8 countries that had like 1 million people each, you know, marching or whatever. That was kind of shut down a little bit. But it still seems like we have half the people that are like still gung-ho about all this, right? Like it's pretty divided, and it seems pretty shocking. Like, how do these people not see like this path that they're going down?
It's a mass psychosis. That's actually the newsletter I'm writing today. Is like, are we currently enthralled in the middle of a mass psychosis? And what is it being driven by? It's being driven by, I mean, fear, right? Fear and uncertainty leads humans to act in very particular ways. And the people that find themselves in places of power in the political sphere, the media sphere, the monetary sphere, and like the expert class sphere, the education sphere, are leveraging fear and uncertainty and the apparatus of the media, particularly, to spread that fear and uncertainty to a cattle herd, the masses.
Yeah. You know, in interesting you say that psychosis. I was listening to a podcast a couple months ago, and it was about NLP, like neuro-linguistic programming, which is what marketing uses. And you can get certified like as a practitioner of NLP, and then you get like this master certification. It's like Tony Robinson uses it, and marketing uses it, and it's like it kind of plants like Inception plants things into your subconscious, right? And so these are these master level practitioners of NLP on this podcast, and they were explaining how the news and the media is actually using NLP on the people. And they gave all these examples, and I don't know it good enough to kind of repeat those back, but a lot of these like sensational headlines, like if you don't wear a mask, you're going to kill grandma, for example, right? And then they repeat it over and over and over, and it actually goes past the conscious into the subconscious, and they're basically brainwashed, or kind of, you know, brainwash these people. And they even went in further, and they said how because of the education system has been so dumbed down to teach you not to question and not to think, that it's easier than ever before to actually use NLP on the people and brainwash them.
It's insane how pervasive it is. So here in the Philadelphia area, I've been watching like a lot of Phillies games, and it happens very nonchalantly. Like in the background, you have the two announcers in the booth just talking about how they got vaccinated and how they feel like liberated, that they're able actually to go live free because the vaccine somehow magically enables them to do that. And driving in the city, if you not in your own car, you're in Uber, and the Uber's listening to the radio instead of what I would typically listen to, is just my playlist on Spotify or something. And you have literal commercials in Philadelphia. I'm sure this is in other areas too, but it blew my mind the first time I heard it, getting an Uber to my brother's apartment from my wife's parents' house in Philadelphia. And the Uber driver was listening to the radio. It was just a commercial: wear a mask, save a life, wear a mask, save a life.
Right.
In the course of a 30-minute drive to the city, that commercial came on three times. And again, that line, wear a mask, save a life. Like, if you say it enough, it begins to make people question, like, if I don't wear a mask, am I causing people to die? And so like they feel forced to do that to save their fellow man. And it's really scary how easy it is to manipulate the masses. And we see evidence that the people in media know this, and they leverage this specifically. Project Veritas had that expose on the CNN producer, who basically admitted, like, Jeff Zucker would call us on the red phone with the direct line to the president's office, and he'd say, put the death numbers back on the screen. We need people to be afraid. People are turning away because you don't have the death numbers on. They need that fear-inducing stat to draw their attention and to draw them in. And then I'm actually very happy that Project Veritas came out with it, because it showed the playbook too. He's like, next, when COVID dies down, we're going to go to climate change. We're going to start fear mongering over that. And it's disgusting that they intentionally, in some parts of the media, particularly the mainstream media, leverage the fear and uncertainty to drive a discussion. And it's all for advertising dollars and clicks and views. And it's a perverse incentive system that's been erected by the advertising model in mainstream media, particularly.
Yeah. Well, as back to kind of marketing analogy, like you mentioned kind of earlier, like that motivation of fear, and like humans are pretty basic. I mean, we're motivated by, one, moving away from pain, and two, moving towards pleasure, like pain and pleasure. I think fear, pain, is the more powerful one than the pleasure. But switching from a message of pain and despair to maybe a message of hope, you know, I 2008, you know, it was a great financial crash, rocked my world as well. I was maybe a little bit older, And I had been a real estate investor. I started at 18. I've been a real estate investor for, I don't know, almost 10 years at that point, and made a lot of money, sold a couple businesses, but I got wiped out. And I was like, what the heck is this financial casino? Like, I don't know anything about it. And I started digging in and I became a gold bug. And I was like, oh, we got to fix the money. That's what it is, right? We got to gold. That's the way. It took me a couple years to realize I wasn't necessarily a gold bug. I was a sound money advocate. you know, I then became very disillusioned with the system. Like, I mean, it's ruined. Like, we need to fix the system. And I was just kind of given up on politics and all that. And it was about 2015 that I finally went and took the plunge into Bitcoin. And it was like, hey, sorry to interrupt this video just one more time. I'm not running Google ads, so it's actually way less interruption than I normally would have on a video. And that's because it's sponsored by BlockFi. They are opening up the world of Bitcoin and financial products, offering to pay you interest on your Bitcoin, better than owning a rental property that you have to manage and control and have the risks. You can just earn interest on it, or you can leverage against it. Now, I plan to hold my Bitcoin forever and literally never sell my Bitcoin. So how do you do that? Well, if I need money, I don't want to sell that Bitcoin. I'm going to pay tax on it. All right. I'm going to end up with less and I don't have the Bitcoin anymore. So a better way to do it is to borrow against the Bitcoin. So I've put all my money into Bitcoin. If I want to buy a car or I want to buy a house, I can borrow against it at very, very low competitive rates, get my house, get my car, whatever that may be, and get to keep the Bitcoin. Now, I've done a whole video on this. You can find it. I'll link it down in the description below, how to retire off of Bitcoin without paying taxes. And you can do that with BlockFi services. I'll link to the video down below. I'm also going to put a link to BlockFi. If you choose to click on that link to check them out, you can earn up to $250 in free Bitcoin just for using that link. And that's it. Let's go ahead and get back to the interview. Now we have a tool. Like, now we actually have something. Like, now it's hope, right? Like, now we have a fighting chance. And I'm a Second Amendment supporter. I got a bunch of, I'm not going to say it, but I don't ever want to use those things. That's the last thing I want. And like, realistically, we don't stand a chance with those anyway. But now we have a tool, you know? And so there is a message of hope. And so I want to kind of pivot into that, because you got me really motivated on a show that you had talking with Paul from Sphinx Chat. And it just kind of shifted my focus. And so I want to talk about that. Another analogy, I grew up racing dirt bikes, and like, when you're racing dirt bikes, I mean, you're hauling ass and I've broken every bone in my body. And like, there's like a rut that I need to hit, and there might be a rock on this side and a rock on this side, but I got to focus on the rut. If I look at the rocks, I'm probably going to hit them. So you're like golf, right? Like, you look at the green, not the sand trap. And so I think in life we get very busy looking at all the problems and all these things that we're afraid of and we can't fix. When I had the analogy listening to that show, it's like, why not just focus on where we want to go and how much more powerful it is? And so, you know, and I'd like for you to talk about this. I mean, you're interviewing him all the time, but like, people are out there building a parallel system. They're not living in fear. Like, they're just out there doing it, right?
Yeah, no, that's the beauty of Bitcoin, right? It's an open source system that allows you to build on it, to add to it, to build products on top of it, to leverage its ledger, to anchor value into it, to anchor truth into it, right? And you don't have to work within the parameters of the traditional financial system, which have very specific rules and are very constricting. They've created very large regulatory and compliance moats that make it impossible for the little man, the upstarter, to actually build and innovate. It's a very insider's club. And if you're not in it, you're not going to be able to do anything to change that system. So Bitcoin provides a system in which you can build in parallel and build a competing financial system and arguably like a system through which to coordinate economic activity. Maybe it's not directly on chain, but you can settle everything in Bitcoin, and that leads to innovation, the likes of which is literally impossible within the traditional system. So like Paul and Sphinx, they're leveraging Bitcoin's second layer, which is the Lightning Network, to enable podcasters to monetize. So they're allowing people like us to monetize without the traditional advertising model. We can have our viewers engage in a value for value model where they send us a few sats per minute listen, like fractions of a penny. But if we develop audiences that like what we're putting out there, and they get value out of the content that we're putting out there, and they want to send value back to us, it could be very small amounts of value, but in aggregate, then it can be a material amount of Bitcoin that allows us to produce the content that we want to produce without having to rely on advertisers or any other type of monetization path. And so that's just one example of something that's enabled by Bitcoin that was never possible and people are building. Like you wanted to send fractions of a penny per minute to a podcaster of your liking. You literally could not do that using the infrastructure that's been built out by Visa or MasterCard.
Yeah, it's insane.
And if you're talking uncouth or you're speaking wrong think on your podcast, you can have those people cut you off immediately at the knees, the payment providers. And that's simply impossible with Bitcoin. You can.
And we can see it happening right now with Joe Rogan. It's back again. I mean, everyone's mad about something he said. I don't even know what it was, but.
It was something we touched on earlier. He basically said something that should be common sense is like, hey, if you look at the statistics on the CDC website, it is asinine that we're forcing children to wear masks. I mean, I don't think he was echoing what Tucker Carlson said specifically. I don't think he said it because of Tucker. I think he actually recorded this episode before that Tucker episode aired earlier this week, but he said like, it's child abuse. Like these kids are not getting it and they're not spreading it. Like it's becoming, evident. And then if you're a young, healthy 21-year-old, why are you getting this experimental vaccine? Like you don't need it. Like the statistics show, like even if you're obese in your, in this particular age group, you're probably not going to die from it. Like the risk of the RR on taking an experimental mRNA vaccine is probably not worth it for you. Like if you're going to get COVID, chances are you're going to survive and people are jumping down his throat. And again, it drives back to fear. You know, the people are in the CNN and there's that death count up there. And just,
but whatever happened to people just like, hey, I don't like what he's saying. Like, let me just change the channel.
Well, like, so I mean, with this particularly, like I think there's a lot of people who don't want to admit they've been gypped to a certain extent over the course of the last year. Like they sacrificed a lot. We shut down the economy. People stayed home from work. They stayed away from their families. They stayed away from meeting with friends. They stayed away from living their lives for a literal year. And to hear somebody come out and say that like it might be insane to force children to make the sacrifices we've been asking them to make. We force young adults to make those sacrifices or experiment with this vaccine so people can get back to normal. It makes people angry because they're like, well, did I get gypped? Like, no, you have to do this. Like we were told this is the way it is. And it is this way because I made these sacrifices. Like my sacrifices weren't made in vain.
Yeah.
People admit that the expert class may have duped them.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, I think a lot of the angst that you see of people that are complying, maybe they're not so mad at you because like you're putting them in danger. They're mad at you because you're not also complying. But that's the whole thing about like getting outside, getting that outside perspective and like changing the worldview. But shifting back into that for a minute, you had started talking about, you know, Bitcoin and building like this different monetary system. And before we were recording, you're talking about a conversation you had with Parker where he was talking about, you know, building a platform that allows people to go save the world. Like he didn't want to save it, but go, you know, give people the tools to do that. And then you said, you know, something that we repeat a lot, which is then fix the money, fix the world. Yeah. Why don't you go into that?
Yeah. Again, I mean, going back to what I said earlier, like when you mess up the pricing mechanism, then the money that is used to measure value throughout an economy, you distort economic decisions, particularly capital allocation. And so there's a good argument to be made that because we the money by going off of sound monetary standard and completely detaching ourselves in 1971, just printing money out of nothing, pretending like there's going to be no consequences, that you have a mass misallocation of capital. The opportunity costs simply aren't as high as they arguably should be when you're making these economic decisions. So when you have a sound monetary system, sound monetary good in the form of Bitcoin, like you increase the opportunity cost of misallocating capital inappropriately. And so the housing market is a perfect example. The mass misallocation of capital that went on in the housing market leading up to 2008 and arguably now again in modern day and today in 2021, like is being induced by a low interest rate environment and a search for yield because people can't preserve purchasing power over time and just putting dollars in a savings account. Then there's arguably a massive misallocation of capital in the shale industry. I'm very intimately aware of the problems that the shale industry has had over the last decade as well. They've had a lot of access to cheap capital. They drilled a lot of more wells than maybe they probably should have. They've expended, excuse me, extended themselves. They've spread themselves very thin. And last year in March, when we had one economic hiccup, you saw like a collapse in the industry. And over the last 12 months, we've seen an insane amount of mergers and acquisitions and bankruptcies.
Yeah.
And this is because capital was allocated that maybe shouldn't have been and probably wouldn't have been if we lived under a sound monetary system. And so fix the money, fix the world is you need to fix the pricing mechanism, particularly the pricing of opportunity costs that exists when you make these economic decisions, these capital allocation systems to efficiently allocate capital.
Yeah.
To efficiently allocate capital.
It's such a big concept that it's, I think it's hard for most people to really grasp. Like you talk about like pricing and they just kind of, okay, that's about money, right? But it's like, no, it affects every area of life. And the website, you know, WTF happened in 1971 is like perfect. It shows you every area of life that's been affected by that pricing allocation or misallocation. But you talked about like the shale oil boom. I got caught in that boom, that or the bust, I should say, that sucked. But in regards to that, then we even take a look at, you know, maybe the shift of fear from, you know, being sick, we'll call it that, right? Fear of being sick to now fear of like the whole world's going to die, right? Climate change or climate emergency now or whatever that may be. And I think when you start even looking at those types of policies, which is interesting enough, the Fed now, apparently they're going to fix the climate with money. But really it's the money.
They're going to fix racial inequality too.
The Fed's gender and racial inequality and the climate. But when you fix the money, you even fix those things, right? And I was having a conversation with Jeff Booth, I think earlier this week, and he was talking about how like the Fed fiat policy actually hurts the environment because it forces like creates this consumption, you know, model and growth at all costs. And like, that's a much bigger problem.
Yeah. And again, like if you're misallocating capital, you're misallocating capital towards things that are going to take energy to be produced, right? There's so many layers to it, right? Like fix the money, fix the world. So it fixes capital allocation. And then like it literally helps capital preservation and accumulation, which is important for the individual and family balance sheets. So that's massive. And like in terms of the misallocation of capital enabled by the fiat monetary system, yes, like enables more energy to be converted into electricity than otherwise would have been if the opportunity cost for particular endeavors like making plastic trinkets that people buy at dollar stores, like maybe even people don't see a reason to invest in those in the future. So you use less petroleum products to build those little plastic trinkets, and maybe you allocate your capital, build something that'll last 100 years, so you don't have to keep replenishing. Like look at the suburban explosion that we've seen over the last 30 years. Like these are all houses that are literally built with shit that is only meant to last the life of a 30-year mortgage. I'm sitting in one of them right now, like here in the Jersey Shore. Like it's a bunch of cookie cutter plastic houses that were thrown up in haste because people are chasing this real estate market because they need to store value because they can't store value in their native currency. And so they have to store value in these properties that are seen as more valuable than others and in better places than others. And so real estate is an example of something that should be a consumption good. And the price is arguably extremely inflated because people are using it as a store of value. And the people are building the houses don't care to build a house that'll last 100 years. They only need a house that'll last 30 years so they can actually build it and sell it to people who are looking to store value in it. And it's very weird. It's very perverse, right? Using this as a store of value, and it's actually not even going to be able to stand up without a complete remodel, remake, structural rebuild within 30 years. It's a lot of things that probably wouldn't be built, materials that wouldn't have been used if we were under a sound monetary system.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example. And we were talking earlier about, you know, going and surfing in some third world countries and stuff. I like to go to some pretty remote places, spend a lot of time in Mexico and Central America. And when you go down there, they fix everything. Like they don't throw away anything. They're like the most ingenious people. Like they can fix anything. And but you know, they don't have the benefit of this fake fiat money system. I mean, obviously they're on one, but not, you know, the world reserve currency. And so they're you know, their economies run differently. And so those people are forced not to be on this consumption, right? They're more on the saving model, and they fix everything. Whereas, you know, back to, you know, America, it's like, we just throw everything away.
Yeah.
Even we were going down on a surf trip and we were driving and we were in Mexico and my friend's truck broke down and his starter had gone out and he went and we towed it over to a shop and they rebuilt the starter. Like in America, they would never rebuild the starter. They would just replace it.
Right.
It's
extremely wasteful, right? Like the whole energy debate really grinds my gears. The energy hysterics, the climate emergency people forcing this narrative on to the populace. And again, leveraging fear.
Greta
Thunberg.
Yeah.
The world's going to be under the oceans in 12 years. Or Greta, you said that when you're 16, when you're 28, I'm going to call you and say, hey.
Well, they've all said it. Al Gore's been saying it since like 2009.
Like, well, that's another thing. Like, I forget the gentleman's name, but he was President Obama's lead science advisor. 1985, he said that by the year 2021, this year, there would be a billion climate-related deaths due to climate change.
Yeah.
At the time, that's what they were calling it, climate change. Over the course of that 36-year period, climate-related deaths fell by 98%.
So, yeah.
Like literally, I become completely Alex Epstein pilled. We use these energy, like the more electricity that we're using, the better off humans are. The lower you drive the cost of electricity, the more humans will flourish. And I think that's the message we need to start permeating. We need more electricity. We need to use more energy. Of course, we should eliminate waste and be as efficient as possible, which is like where I think we help out at Great American Mining.
Right.
By particularly using gas would otherwise be flared as a way to create electricity to mine Bitcoin to create positive economic value for producers and just the economy at large. There's a mass psychosis. There's people driving narratives that find no base in logic or reality. And people are catching it hook, line, and sinker because they have that amygdala that is designed to react to fear, right?
Yeah.
I know you want to just hopeful, but I can't, like,
I want to dig into that energy thing that you just brought up. That's a good point to talk about. The first thing is, though, it's crazy because, like, everyone, I guess, right, nobody wants to put the hard work of, like, diet and exercise. I just want the magic pill to lose weight. And I guess maybe the same way with their education, like, I just want to read a headline and I won't even bother to read the article kind of a thing or even think about it. So like everyone's like repeating these headlines, but without even like stopping to think about it. A couple of things about that are just crazy. So first of all, like if Bitcoin wastes energy, well, what's a waste? Like one man's trash is another man's treasure, isn't it? Like there's a bunch, like all that time consumed on TikTok, how much energy is that wasting, right? Or whatever. The other thing that's crazy is they talk about, you know, let's say that if all this is true, and the climate does go up by 1.5 degrees. Well, the goal is to get it down by 1.5. But let's say they don't achieve that goal, so it doesn't go down by 1.5. Okay, like I live in Southern California. It's a desert. In Arizona, it's 125 degrees in the summer. They created air conditioning. But the craziest part is those same people are talking about how we're going to go colonize Mars, which is completely uninhabitable.
Yeah, like, there's no basis in reality or logic. Again, I'm sitting here. I have skin in the game. I live on a barrier island right now. It's literally, you have the ocean, this island, and the bay. That's all that's between here and the mainland, southern New Jersey. I've lived on this island my whole life, in the summers particularly. Yeah. If anywhere is going to like fall underwater, it would be this island. And yes, the island has experienced more floods over the course of my life, but that's not because of rising sea levels. It's because we ripped out all the trees for these shitty houses, and the island literally can't absorb the water.
Yeah,
and it is. So another example I'd like to use is particularly Bitcoin. Like, so Bitcoin mining industry gets picked on for one reason or another. Again, like you mentioned, why are people saying that Bitcoin miners converting energy into electricity is a waste. We'll get into why or their justification for that statement in a little bit. But there was a woman 2 months ago in California posted a tweet with four pictures of Bitcoin mining warehouses. And like, you do the research to find out where the mining warehouses is. I believe one was in Kazakhstan, One was in China, one was in like upstate New York, and another somewhere else in the United States, not in California. So she posted those four pictures of Bitcoin mining warehouses. And she said, look at this, like all these Bitcoin miners are using all this electricity. Meanwhile, here in California, we're having rolling blackouts and brownouts.
Yeah,
basically trying to say that the energy being converted to electricity by the Bitcoin mining warehouses in completely different parts of the world, nowhere near connected to the California energy grid, were the cause for those rolling blackouts and brownouts in California. When in fact, the real cause, and I'm sure you're intimately aware of this since you're from California, is they decommissioned natural gas and nuclear power plants without replenishing the power generation. Like people literally don't understand how grids work or how power is generated or how it's delivered to individuals and why it's important. Yeah. They literally just want to see the headline, Bitcoin miners are using a lot of energy. They see that. They say, hey, we're having blackouts here because of the Bitcoin miner. It has no basis in reality or logic, yet people run with it. They are able to get fear clicks and virtue signal clicks and quote retweets and all that. And somehow Bitcoin gets demonized.
Yeah. To that point, I know that intimately because that was actually September of last year. I was actually down in Mexico on a surf trip down in Puerto Escondido. And there's like one paved road that goes through town. It's mostly all dirt roads. And at home in California, they were having the rolling blackouts, as you said.
Yeah, no, it is asinine, right? Because they're again, we saw it in Texas this year. It's dangerous. And Mark, like I again, like you said, you before we started recording, you can feel me. You said you can like notice that I'm getting more outspoken against it because I think it's imperative, right? These people, if they get their way. Yeah. It is going to be terrible for humanity. They're pushing us towards unreliable energy resources and wind and solar particularly. Right. And I don't think these people actually care about renewable energy. I think they want control. And I think they want us to use less electricity and less energy because they have some weird like hippie mindset that we need to protect Mother Earth and like just live off the land, which is not going to happen. Many more people. Nature is a vicious bitch and she will kill all of us if we revert to that type of living. And they're pushing us towards these unreliable sources. And like, and again, the reason why I think it's evil and they actually don't care about renewable energy, it's very anti-human, is because they don't advocate for nuclear, which is like the cleanest, most energy dense energy source that we have on the earth. They're decommissioning nuclear power plants all across the country. And what is really fucked up about all this is that it affects the poor the worst. You raise electricity prices and it affects the poor the most aggressively. Rich people, it's going to suck. They're going to have to pay more for electricity, but they will be fine. Their lives are not going to change that materially. But the poor people is going to change. It's literally like a racist anti-poor person policy. And it's coming from people who act like they want to save the world and want to uplift the struggling common man. And it's complete bullshit.
Yeah. I want to go back to a little bit of a message of hope and talk about how Bitcoin is actually good for the environment as opposed to the bad. But before I do, I want to make one more comment. to that point, in that video that I made talking about that policy, I talked about, I have a problem that everyone has this very rigid thinking and they don't consider that everything is a trade-off, everything. And so I made the calculation that so obviously wind and solar only works for part of the day, right? When the sun's out or when the wind's blowing. So then you have unreliable power. So then you have to be able to store the power, right? So you have to have some sort of batteries. The largest battery manufacturer in the United States is the Gigafactory. And it would take, I believe the math I'd worked out in the video was 5,000 years to make enough batteries to store the energy for the US for one day. But then think about this. What goes into the batteries? Rare earth minerals, elements. Where do those come from? From the ground. How do they get them? From mining. And it's been whatever it is, 6, 7, 8 months since I made that video. So I don't remember off the top of my head, but they had to turn over tons of ground to get enough minerals for one battery. So like they would literally have to like dig up half the world. And most of it's in the Amazon. That's why most of the Amazon is burning because they're trying to get the minerals. So they'd have to dig up like half the world, turn it over with tractors and diesel and child labor and all that to get the minerals for the batteries. that's the trade-off. Like, does that sound like a worthwhile trade-off? And like, you just have to understand those things.
And that's just for the batteries. If you actually want to create the solar panels, like you have to burn an insane amount of coal to get, like you literally have to burn coal because nothing else gets hot enough to create the materials necessary to create the panels for solar specifically. And like, this is the problem. Like, I'm not like, I'm all for electricity generation. Like if we figure out a way to do wind and solar, I'm all for it. Like, I'm not anti wind and solar. I'm just like, I'm anti the fact that they're unreliable and the trade-offs, like you just mentioned, are not articulated up front. The argument that is being made by these crazy people is one that is not based, again, in reality, or they're not doing it genuine. It's not a genuine argument they're making. They're hiding a lot of the facts and a lot of the externalities that go into the production of the energy resources they're trying to bring to market. And it's again, it's anti-human. It's going to set us back. And I get with Bitcoin, specifically Bitcoin as a rallying cry, like Bitcoin has emboldened me to really call out bullshit in the world. It's a good thing about number go up and having fuck you money is like, you can just start to stand up to these people, not worried about getting canceled.
Yeah.
That like, we don't need to kowtow to these people anymore. And so like the way Bitcoin makes us more energy efficient is insane. And that's why it's insane that people pick on Bitcoin for its energy conversion, is because it actually makes us more efficient. Again, at Great American Mining, we go to well pads. We go to remote areas in North Dakota, Wyoming, Texas. We show up. We say, hey, don't just set that natural gas on fire. You're literally just wasting it. There's the ability to take that natural gas, that precious resource, and to get economic value out of it. To just set it on fire and send it to the atmosphere is an incredible shame that we should all be ashamed about.
Yeah.
If we show up, we say, hey, instead of piping that to a flare stack, pipe it to our generators. We'll create electricity, mine Bitcoin. Boom. You're able to take the scarce energy molecule and represent it in the scarce digital good. And you create like a liquid market for these stranded assets. So that's only with natural gas.
Yeah.
Again, with renewables too, it's going out there and it's fine. It's stranded hydroelectric and geothermal particularly. And it's taking advantage of those energy resources that exist out there. And so, like, and that's the other ironic thing about people picking on Bitcoin mining as an industry, particularly, is that as an industry, it literally has the highest penetration of renewable energy as the source for the industry. Like, out of anything, like, it's some estimates range from like 40 to 70%. Like, even if it was 15%, it would be the highest. By penetration out there. And like, so it's orders of magnitude more green than any other industry, yet people decide to pick on it. Again, why do they pick on it? Because it's a lot of communists who don't like the fact that they can't control Bitcoin, particularly its monetary policy.
Yeah.
And they don't think it provides any utility to the world, which is just objectively false. Like, I'm sure it has provided you a lot of utility. It's provided me a lot of utility as a savings vehicle. And I would love for these people to go to these places where Bitcoin is providing incredible utility for people and say it to their faces. Again, they're basing these arguments from a place that isn't based in reality and is literal virtue signaling. And I think it is because they want to be able to control how the world works and how people interact with the world, and they can't control Bitcoin, and it really pisses them off.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd like to add to that. One thing I was kind of thinking when you were talking about that was, you know, it's an attack on lots of things, obviously. And there's an attack on capitalism, obviously, right? Capitalism is slavery now, and capitalism kills people, all these things. But really, capitalism, maybe we need to abandon that word, but like in a free market competitive system, entrepreneurs are out there trying to turn trash into treasure. They're not wasting. No entrepreneur, no business owner is going to go out there and waste resources. You're trying to conserve and maximize resources. And so what I love about what, you know, the mining companies are doing is you're literally going and taking trash that's harmful and you're turning it into something good and productive. It's not a waste. That's actually the opposite of waste, right? I mean, a waste is, I mean, you could say, why do we have the internet? Like, why not just read newspapers? Right, that's a waste. I mean, everything's a waste, but you're literally taking trash that's bad, and then you're turning it into treasure.
Yeah, it's making us extremely energy efficient, which is something that we should be striving to do. And that's another thing too. Like, a lot of these climate hysterics are very hypocritical. Like, I get invited to a lot of debates with them throughout the cryptocurrency space because of what I do at Great American Mining. They look at us, say you're using fossil fuels as your energy generation source, like you're destroying the internet, you're destroying the world, excuse me. But like when you like push them, it's like, all right, asshole, we're doing this video conference. You're in Germany, I'm in the United States. You're using a video conference. Like we could do this audio only. We could do this phone call. It would consume a lot less energy. Why aren't we doing that?
Yeah.
You're all day tweeting about all this and that tweet's being stored on a server that takes up a lot of energy. Like why tweet? You should be sending snail mail to get your message out there. Like it again, the moralization of energy consumption or energy conversion to electricity is a weird and very creepy thing. Like if somebody's willing to pay for electricity, they should be able to do whatever they want for it. And Bitcoin miners go to extreme lengths to make us more energy efficient. Like we're in the middle of North Dakota and places that nobody else wants to go, converting this gas to electricity because nobody else will. We're literally bringing the market to the molecule. We're setting up infrastructure to monetize stranded energy sources, which is a beautiful thing.
I mean, just it's insane from so many levels. Being told what is and what isn't essential, right?
Yeah,
that's not a good use for energy. This is things like that. And I'd say, and I know you're, you know, focus you again. Oh, there. What I was going to say is another thing going back to, I know you're working on stranded gas, but even back to the solar, I think it helps a lot there because the problem with solar is it draws on the energy source. And like those power stations, they can't run. Do I still got you?
Yeah, I got you.
Yeah. They can't run. They can't just run during the day and then shut or run during the night and shut off during the day. And like Bitcoin mining could like be used to like augment that, right? So you could mine during the day, shut it off, let the houses pull at night. So there's a lot of ways that it can be used to actually be good and offset. And I'd like as an industry just to kind of, instead of always being on the defensive and trying to defend, like kind of be a little bit more offensive on that message. You know, I think it could use that.
Completely agree. Yeah, that's like one thing that we made a point at Great America Mining. That's why we have our podcast, is to be more offensive. Like, hey, what we're doing is good. It's providing a lot of value to the producers we work with. The producers we work with are providing a lot of value to the overall economy because they're providing a resource that is essential to make our everyday life possible. Don't kowtow to these people. Like, particularly with renewable energy. Again, Bitcoin mining has the highest penetration of renewable energy as a source of electricity across any industry in the world. It's pretty weird and annoying that it gets picked on. And then, like you said, it actually incentivizes the overproduction of renewable energy. So you can have these demand response systems where you can actually deliver the electricity to the market when they need it most. And that's because you're able to subsidize the construction and maintenance of these renewable projects because you have a buyer of last resort, and Bitcoin miners will actually pay for the electricity when nobody else is willing to. And so it creates these incredible efficiencies all throughout the energy industry, whether it be in the fossil fuel part of it or the renewable part of it. It's a beautiful thing. It's something that we should be celebrating aggressively and vociferously. And yet you have a bunch of communist idiots who have decided to pick on Bitcoin for one reason or another. And again, I think it's because they can't control it, and it represents a true free market money. That pisses them off a lot.
Yeah. All right. Well, good stuff. We covered a lot of ground. I think that's probably a good point to drop off there, but I just love to see it. I love, like we've talked about, you know, just giving people that message of hope, and it's attracting people. And now people are coming out with solutions like what you're doing. It's awesome. Anything that you want to close it out with?
Yeah. And I've been on the aggressive part. I'm jacked up today. Yeah, Bitcoin provides hope. If you want to opt into a system where you can verify everything that's going on, you can actually contribute and you have some control over it, particularly your money. Like you control your money and you know that it's not going to be debased and you're going to be able to verify that every block. Like, come do research on Bitcoin. It's enabling a new economy to be built, a new way of organizing between humans, and the people in the Bitcoin space, at least that I've come into contact with, are some of the smartest and most ingenious people that I've ever met in my life, that are, they're doing beautiful things, and they're doing it because they just want to build a better future. The people in charge do not care about us. They are leading us down a terrible path, and we can't depend on them to make the change that we need in this world. We need to do it ourselves, and Bitcoin provides an incredible vehicle through which to bring the change that we need to wrest control from these kleptocrats and actually ensure that we have freedom and liberty in the digital age.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome. Good stuff. Good note to end it on too. I'm going to make sure to link your podcast, the mining, and your Twitter on the show notes. Anything else coming up that people should be aware of or that should follow you? Are those the best places?
Yeah, Twitter's the best place, at Marty Bent. That's where I hang out most. TFTC.io is my website with all my content. GAM.AI, GAM.AI is the Great American Mining website if you want to figure out what we're doing. Yeah, keep fighting a good fight, Mark. Thank you for having me on.